Hello and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. Should classes on Islam be taught in secular schools? Providing religious education for their children is a major concern for Muslim communities living in the West. Up until just a few years ago, this was provided for at home and in after-school programs. Recently, however, apart from the founding of Islamic educational centers, we have also seen efforts to have these programs integrated into the curricula of the public school system of these countries. This move has generated many questions and responses, which we would like to explore in this issue of Minbar. To discuss them, we are pleased to have on the program Sheikh Muhammad Zakaria, who teaches research methodology at Birkbeck University and at the Islamic College for Advanced Studies in London. Sheikh Zakaria, welcome to Minbar.
Thank you very much, Sheikh.
Now, some say that teaching religion in schools would cause social divisions and destroy community unity, and that, you know, schools should stay away from teaching religion. What is your opinion on this?
Good question. It depends on who's teaching and for what purpose. I think if we have the type of teacher who adopts a honest approach to the teaching of religion, and in particular in this instance to Islam, then yes, all well and good, providing that the individual is qualified in the sense that they understand the complexities which surround teaching a religion, particularly in this postmodern age with all that's gone on over the past 10 years. And also, what is the curriculum? What is going to be taught? Are we going to impart to the children just ritual and some dogma? Or are we going to use the curriculum to empower the individual, regardless of their being Muslim or non-Muslim? So an unqualified, yes, but very cautious because of certain other prerequisites which need to be in place.
When you look at, for example, some of those some of the curricula, the religious curricula for some schools sponsored by countries from the Middle East, you find that some of these curricula have in them some of the subjects discussed or taught in them could be very offensive to, for example, Jews and even Christians. You know, in these texts, for example, you know, they talk very disparagingly about Christians and, you know, Jews and so forth.
Yes.
You know, and this tends to, I think, fuel this really legitimate concern that, you know, teaching religion in schools could create problems, right? I mean, evangelical type Christians, for example, in America, you know, I wouldn't want my kids to be going to a school where they are allowed to spew that kind of bile that you're talking about.
Sure.
So wouldn't this concern have some kind of legitimacy? How can we control this?
Without a doubt, yes, definitely. And there is a case in the news in this country of a school funded by a country in the Middle East, very oil rich, and the syllabus, as it relates to supposed Islamic study, is full of this very negative approach and, you know, producing stereotypes about the Jews, the Christians, etc. It shows how far the individuals are from the reality of Islam. And we should be using what we call Islamic studies, but I think when we use that term, we think of a very limited curricula. Islamic studies is biology, chemistry, psychology, physics, mathematics, etc. Anything which brings the individual closer to their deity. But coming back to the point you mentioned, I think, yes, here are the problems. That when you transfer from outside of the country a curricula which was developed abroad and you try and teach it here, in England, you're going to run into problems. The approach here is multiculturalism. All cultures are equal. All religions are equal. And the Islamic approach is one of respect for one and all. Yes, we don't agree with the belief of Jews, let's say, or the belief of Christians, Hindus, Sikhs, or Buddhists, etc. But how we approach their faith is one of approach of understanding. We don't insult because we don't want to be insulted.
And mutual respect.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Now, there are denominationally based schools and part-time programs that provide religious instruction, you know. And some people will say, isn't this a duplication of efforts? On one level, you have these denominationally based schools, these part-time programs going on for them to educate their own kids and mm-hmm. so on. And at the same time, you have it in the regular school system. Mm-hmm. What would be your response to that?
The denominational based schools, you know what they are. Either they're CFE, Church of England, or Roman Catholic, or Jewish, Muslim, etc. But the school, in my opinion, should be open to one and all. And as such, when the, let's say, the Hindu child is in a Jewish school, if it's the school is adhering to the teachings of Judaism, or adhering to the teaching of Christianity, or whatever faith they follow, then the child should feel welcome. It shouldn't pose a problem, because at the root of all, let's say, sacred religion, is a respect for the humanity of individuals. And there is room enough in my sacred text, let's say, for the respect of others. Mm. When we look at the duplication issue, I honestly think what's gone on in this country has not been good enough. Hence, we need to be producing environments where there is an independence from the state-run sector, whereby we can supplement what our children are missing out. Let's take Islamic studies, for example, in a Islamic school. Islamic studies should encompass learning about the faith of others.
Right.
Okay? And I would argue that the Quran urges us to do that. The Quran is like a document of, as it were, interfaith dialogue. It speaks of Jews, it speaks of Christians, primarily in the early revelations in Medina and in Mecca, and then later on carrying them over to Medina. So for us as Muslims, it shouldn't pose a problem. We should actually welcome the teaching of Islamic studies, but open it up to much more than just history, fiqh, ibadah, etc. Mm. We use it as a tool to explore the faith of others.
Right.
And then come to some kind of understanding of them and a respect for their wants, desires, their insaniyah, their humanity.
Right. So you're looking at teaching religion in secular schools as a means of providing bridges for the mutual understanding between religions.
Definitely.
So what elements would you say should be emphasized in the teaching of any religion, in especially Islam,
sure,
in the secular school system?
You see, what we have here in England is when somebody wants to become a religious studies teacher, first of all, they go away to university, they complete a degree, and then they go to a teacher training college where they study for a year. After that year, now they're fully equipped to go into the classroom, supposedly, to deliver aspects relating to particular faiths. However, what has been found via, you know, rigorous research is that teachers are not equipped with the tools to deliver even the most rudimentary concepts or beliefs with regards to Islam. So what we need to look at are the teacher training courses, which are supposedly meant to prepare individuals to deliver aspects of Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Sikhism within a particular classroom. When we look at what should be taught, I think we need to focus on what's common.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say there are issues where the issues which we disagree on, we shouldn't look at as well. But I think first concentrate on that which is common, build up some commonality, some understanding, and so that individual students can see, well, you know, there is some similarity between us. If we're looking at secondary school, under 16 years of age, those type of students are very inquisitive. They want to know why. And they're very eager to visit places of worship, etc. So concentrate on what is common, i.e. the belief in deity. And what does the belief in deity demand from us? Well, it demands that we respect one and all. And what we see is, via a belief in deity, a very multifaceted approach to worship. That could be singing, it could be dancing, or it could be, as Muslims do, performing their five times a day prayer. But what is common is this belief in deity, and from that, a respect for all human beings.
So why are these teachers ill-equipped to teach this subject? Is the problem existing on a university level, or is it on a social level?
I think the universities, when it comes to the teaching of Islam, let's take a typical university here in London. I won't mention the name. Now, we have X amount of Muslims in this country. We are the second in England. We are the second largest faith community in the country. And let's say over a 35-week period, the students are introduced to or have two sessions of exposure to the teachings of Islam throughout a 35-week period.
Two sessions.
The majority, quite rightly so, is given over to Christianity. But then when you look at faiths such as Hinduism, Sikhism, Buddhism, Judaism, they all have the same amount of time dedicated to them as Islam does.
Which is two sessions.
Now, when you look at the numbers of Muslims in this country and the diversity of the Muslim population and the geographical location of the Muslim population in this country, you need to ask yourself, well, what's going on here? When we look at the textbooks which are used to introduce the trainee teacher into the teaching of Islam, the textbooks are predominantly written by non-Muslims or Muslims. And when it's written by a Muslim and they comment on, let's say, the different denominations within Islam, they bring their bias or they bring their, let's say, innocent ignorance regarding a particular group they're speaking of. Mm-hmm. And here I mean the Shia, if not Ashari. Mm-hmm. So definitely the problem is to be identified at the university level also, and secondly, at the level of the textbooks which are produced for the students to gain some kind of understanding of Islam. And compounded even further by the syllabus or the curriculum which is put forward by independent examination boards in this country. Mm. When it comes to the portrayal of the Shia, we are seen as something, well, far removed from Islam. Not on the fringes, as some people would allow us to be, but outside the pale of Islam. And these are syllabi, these are qualifications which are put together by examination boards. And so you've got a conflation of the problem. It's not only found within the university itself, not only found within the textbook, but also found outside with the examination boards themselves.
So now, is anybody in the Shia community making any effort to redress this particular problem?
We have tried. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that our Sunni brothers, they predominate, and they have been more active than us in having their voice heard. But also it's a historical problem as well, because when you look at this country and many of the Western European countries, the earliest exposure they had to Muslim peoples, even in North Africa, or in, let's say, what we call Turkey now, the people who they had exposure to followed a particular theology, and that was an Ash'arite theology. Mm. They came from the Ahl Sunnah. And what happened within a Western academia was a belief that Islam is typified by one particular approach, and that is the Ash'arite approach.
Right.
Therefore, this belief is still with us to this day. So books which are produced, textbooks which are produced, syllabi which are written, are all predicated on the belief that this group is the so-called orthodox group, and they represent the mainstay of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
It's only now in the later, or the latter 20th century, in the early 21st century, that Western academics are waking up to the fact that no, there is another rich trend, the trend of the Ithna Ashari, Shia Ithna Ashari, and although they're a minority, we need to listen to them. So there are some voices within the Shia community and outside trying to readdress this, but we're playing catch up.
Mm-hmm. What about other trends in Islam, other approaches in Islam, for example, Sufism?
Well, funnily enough, Sufis were given a very good portrayal within, let's say, the textbooks, etc. I don't know whether it's with regards to their very quiet approach, supposedly quiet approach to their faith and their so-called spiritual orientation. When you look at the various schools within the rich Sufi tradition, predominantly the West is has been exposed to the Naqshbandi school, and you find many of the books on Sufism, which predominate in the West and are used for the teaching of Sufism in the curricula, come from Naqshbandi sources. So yes, other trends within Islam are covered, and I find that they find a more favorable, let's say, portrayal than do the Shia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is the origin of this initial knee-jerk reaction by the host community, the host society, meaning white Christian Britain, for example? Mm-hmm. What is the source of the knee-jerk reaction against teaching religion in schools?
Well, I think it has historical factors linked to it. I think you go back to when, let's say, in this country, England was a Catholic country, and then you go through the Reformation, Henry the, I think the Eighth, breaking off from Rome and now bringing into being the Church of England, and then later on the separation of church and state, etc. And then religion not really fitting into what we call the postmodern life. Sacred religion is something very far removed from the psyche of the majority of the people in this country. And we're talking about white British people. Although Britain is said to be a Christian country, but when you compare, let's say, the religiosity, as it were, of the majority of the people, then I wouldn't say they're not religious in the in the sacred sense.
Right.
They may be religious in the secular sense,
uh-huh.
but when it comes to following a sacred path, then definitely not. But I think what they feel is that religion is backward. We were there already, and we have passed through a number of stages. We've gone through industrialization. We're in the post-industrialized era now. Science, whatever that is, has the answers. We don't need superstition anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see is an approach from both a sociological angle, a psychological angle, even anthropological and economic angles to push religion to the furthest corners that they can, and allow that space vacated by religion to be occupied by, let's say,
science.
Science.
Yes, or ideology.
Yes.
So could we probably put it down to the ideology of progressivism? You know, the whole idea like progress entails leaving what you have gone through, experienced behind, and looking towards the future, that type of a thing?
Well, probably, but, you know, I honestly think that when you take the belief of the British non-Muslim who comes from a Christian background into consideration, maybe they will say, well, look, I'm not Christian in the traditional sense, but I'm Christian in a new evolved sense. Mm. Whatever that is, I couldn't really say, but I wouldn't want to say that they don't see themselves as Christian, because usually when you ask them, what is your faith, are you Muslim or are you Christian? Mm. They usually come down and say, you know, on the side of Christianity.
Right.
So yes, definitely there is an evolving, but as they evolve, they move away from the essence, and that is a belief in a sacred being mm-hmm. who will ask us what we did with his treasures, mm-hmm. i.e. the earth which we are given to use to better our own positions and the positions of others.
It's very interesting, because you find that this type of trend is also taking place among some Muslims as well, living in these societies. We have to take a quick break, and we will be right back with Sheikh Muhammad Zakaria speaking on the question, should religious education be included in the secular school curricula? Stay tuned. Welcome back. And we're talking with Sheikh Muhammad Zakaria on the question, should religious studies be included in the curricula of a secular school system? Now, how should Islam be, the teaching, how should the teaching of Islam be controlled in a secular curriculum? I mean, a lot of Muslims will say, all right, if the secular system accepts and agrees to sponsor or have religious education in their schools, then it is to their discretion whoever they hire to teach this. Mm. You sort of hinted at it earlier on, sure. In terms of, you know, teachers who may not even be Muslims, mm-hmm. Have a qualification from university, get their qualification from the teacher training program,
right.
And then they come in mm-hmm. and they teach. Now, a Muslim might say, well, okay, well, I need to control my image. Probably this person has no idea what Islam is all about. Probably this person has no idea as to what precisely they should teach. How could we control this?
Mm. I'm not sure whether the word control it is the right one. I think really what I would prefer to say is, how can we as Muslims help the school deliver an inclusive program of Islamic studies under the heading of religious education? We are notorious for not getting involved with the school system or the schooling of our children. The days when we could send our children to school and the child had deference for the teacher, and there was, you know, a dominant authoritarian figure in the school which would order the school environment, and everybody would get along happily and come out with some kind of beneficial education, have gone. That's if they existed. What we need to do is we need to be actively involved with the school system by joining PTA, Parent Teachers Associations, mm-hmm. by becoming school governors, by getting involved in fundraising, by suggesting to the religious studies teacher or the board of governors or even the head teacher certain texts, certain
other resources, such as ICT resources, or inviting the individuals over to our centres. You know, a good time is Ramadan, where teachers could come over and break fast with us and see what we're all about, so that Islam doesn't remain in a book, something which they are delivering purely on an academic level as a teacher. The stakes are too high for that to be allowed to continue. Why? Because of what's happened here in England with regards to the atrocities which were committed. Islam is, for want of a better word, under attack. We're under pressure, and we need to up our game. And if we don't up our game, things will run away from us. So one of the easier ways, or one of the better ways of readdressing the negative image of Islam, is by engaging within the school system.
Right.
We're not trying to brainwash, we're not trying to interfere with the teacher's valuable teaching. Actually, you know, we as Muslims, we value teachers. What we're trying to do is help the teacher deliver a study of Islam which truly reflects the beliefs, the wants, the desires of the Muslim communities here in this country.
What are the internal and external factors that prevent Muslims or compromise Muslims in trying to achieve that? And by internal, I mean the psychological makeup, the headspace, so to speak. You know, and external, I mean maybe social attitudes, laws, rules and regulations, things that might prevent them from doing that.
You see, most of the Muslim, most of those who make up the Muslim communities, the length and breadth of this country, come from the Indian subcontinent. Okay, over the course of, let's say, 15 or 20 years, people have come in from different regions. Primarily, when we speak of the various Muslim communities here, they arrived for economic reasons, post-Second World War, to fill the labor shortage. And their main, let's say, raison d'etre was to achieve economic stability, maybe stay here for a few years, send money back home to their parents and help their brothers and sisters also come over and live the dream. As things changed and people began to settle, the hope of one day wanting to go back home has really gone. Usually when we go back home in a box to be buried in the Kabistan, in the village. But predominantly we're here settled. Many of us, the first generation and some of the second generation, brought an attitude to education that the teacher knows best, and the teacher has the best wants for our children at heart. That may have been the model back home, but the model here is completely different. It's no longer community-based education. Children travel from outside of a borough to receive their education, so they're not known by the teacher, nor do the students know the teacher. It's a very large mishmash of individuals coming from different areas, etc., different social classes. We now, as Muslims, approaching the education system, I think we saw ourselves as not able to actively engage with the education system because of a number of reasons. Maybe there was a language barrier. You know, if you look at those from the Indian subcontinent, their first language maybe Punjabi or Urdu. They couldn't communicate. They didn't have the language skills. It was left for the child now being sent to the school to acquire the language skills, even to translate for the parents in the shop or, you know, outside in the wider social setting. A perception of inferiority, that the school itself is not our domain. We're unable to actively engage with the teachers because we don't have the cultural capital, we don't have the tools to aggressively, I don't mean aggressive, but I mean effectively engage with the school so they can know our wants, we can know theirs, and we can come to some amicable arrangement in delivering a program of study which truly reflects the beliefs of the diverse Muslim communities here in this country. And secondly, I think the education system, the individual schools also, were bastions of teachers know best. And any constructive criticism was seen as a negative critique of how Islam, or let's say any other faith, was being represented. But the truth of the matter is, Islam still to this day, even in the teacher training programs, in the universities, even amongst Muslims, is hardly known.
Mm-hmm.
The individual on the street, the individual Britisher, they don't know anything about right. Islam. What they know of Islam is the folk devil, which is portrayed on the TV. And unfortunately, we Muslims, via our not so good behavior, we feel that. So you bring these two together, you've got the current situation today.
So while you're talking, I'm thinking in my mind, well, language barriers, you know, bringing over with yourself, certain attitudes between teacher and student, you know what I mean? I'm thinking that, okay, now we're in the 21st century. Now a lot of these people who have come over, right, are either now, I mean, their great-grandchildren are here and who are very British, you know what I mean? They got no language barriers or what have you. Why haven't they not been able to redress the situation?
I would argue, Sheikh, that there is still a language barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that although we're all speaking English, let's say in the English education system, the meanings behind our words are completely different. So that when the person from the Indian subcontinent uses English and uses certain particular words, they don't have the same meaning as the person who's been brought up here, comes from an Anglo-Saxon background. Predominantly these are the teachers.
Right.
Their use of the language is the same, but there is a different perception, something different behind the words which are being used.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore there is this missing of the intent.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher may be very, you know, very inclusive, very warm, but when they use certain language, the language is perceived by the student in a particular manner, and therefore the student misunderstands what the teacher is saying. But coming away from that more technical approach, yes, you're right. 45 years on, why are we still in this in this position? And it comes down to the issue of apathy. We think that others will do for us. We have to do for ourselves.
How about us thinking we have no power? I'll give an example. I was reading an article recently about the trials and tribulations of people going through JFK Airport in the United States. Okay? And this was a white woman, okay, who was just coming from a Middle Eastern country,
mm-hmm.
and who was also sort of like pulled over.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
You know, and she is in this room where, you know, the Homeland Security people are and so forth. And in the room, there were a lot of brown people, you know, Indians, Arabs, and so forth, who had American passports,
mm-hmm.
but who were just sitting quietly, frustrated, of course, and afraid, waiting for the verdict to be given, or for these people behind the desk, these, you know, guys who look like cops, guns and everything, to make their pronouncements.
Off to Guantanamo kind of thing.
Yeah, you know. And this woman got up and was starting to criticize these people. Why are you keeping us here for so long? What are the bases for you detaining us? And she was creating a big ruckus,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the other people said to her, thank you very much. You know, but what it highlighted, right, was that here you have two Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? Most likely some of them having been born in America, but having a different attitude towards their rights. One is willing to actually stand up for their rights mm-hmm. and argue for their rights. The other is not. And I have a feeling it goes back to this internal understanding of where you are.
Colonization, yeah. Post-colonialism, etc. Even you can pick it up in writing. You know, when you look at the writing, let's say, of certain students who come from outside of Europe, those areas which were colonized by Western European powers, and they're writing essays, you can see that they're still writing as a defeated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, obviously there's a whole area of study behind that, the colonial writing and the post-colonial writing. When are we going to come out of that? Definitely. I totally agree and I understand where you're coming from. Yes, I think maybe it comes down to, you know, we don't see ourselves as fully part and parcel of this society
right.
with regards to our rights. And I don't think that is a fault of the society itself. It's our fault. We need to be proactive individuals. Mm-hmm. We need to seize our rights.
So how do we break out of that?
Oh, gosh.
What do we need to do to break out of this sense of self-imposed powerlessness?
And here I profess my ignorance. Mm. I can only do it with regards to my family or myself, and that is by bringing my children up in a way which says to them, you're part and parcel of the society, giving them an understanding of who they are and where they come from, giving them a perception of this rich Islamic culture, this rich Islamic tradition, which lies at the root of their very being. And they can go anywhere in the world and interact with anybody on par. You see, coming back to the point which we made with regards to the teacher training programs and the curricula, the examination boards producing certain curricula which is just one-sided or completely biased against the Shia. When large Shia organizations have contacted these boards, they haven't contacted them as we are on par with you.
As equals. Yes.
Rather it's the, to use a term, the house slave syndrome.
An ingratiating type of a thing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Whereas you're misrepresenting our faith and there is no reason for you to do it. Here is what we actually believe. You have a duty to take it on board. Because given the climate now today, when a faith or when a group within a particular faith are denigrated, are seen as lunatics, are seen as irrational, women beaters, etc., this is fuel for parties like the British National Party, which have an ultra-racist agenda. And what could be said is, well, see, look who we have amongst us in our midst. We have a fifth column, which is bent upon the destruction of this society and all that is wholesome. Okay? So we as Muslims, we need to take the initiative. But, as I was saying, my own personal approach is to empower my children.
Right.
To make them understand that via their father being here and via them being born in this country, they have the right to enjoy everything this country has to offer. And that includes the education system.
Mm-hmm.
And their beliefs, their practices, their history as Muslims should not be misrepresented. And if it is, they have a right within the law to have that redressed.
Right. Now, what are the advantages and disadvantages of teaching Islamic studies in a secular school environment?
Again, it comes to the perception of Islamic studies, this narrow approach that Islamic studies is, as you know, within the madrasa or within the house or within the traditional maktab. It relates to ulum al-Qur'an, sciences of the Qur'an, ilm al-hadith, sciences of the traditions, tafsir, etc. Yes, those subjects are crucial and they're important. But Islamic studies in the school environment has to be completely different, and it actually is. So we address issues of abortion, suicide, euthanasia, okay, issues with regards to the environment, mm-hmm, as well as looking at more scholastic issues such as the cosmological argument, the ontological argument, looking at various ethical theories, Kantian ethics, utilitarian ethics, comparing and contrasting these two rational ethical approaches to sacred ethics, which come from Islam, the divine command theory. So the curricula has to be vast, and has to, well, I say vast, not vast,
comprehensive,
exactly,
yes,
but focused enough so this individual comes out with something worthwhile, and it has to be relevant to the society which they're in. They have to be able, mm-hmm, to use it.
Mm-hmm.
It can't just be purely scholasticism.
Right.
So the non-Muslim student, Sheikh, you'll find, takes the Islamic studies exam in a higher number than Muslims. The majority, mm-hmm, of students who study Islam, mm-hmm, here and in the secondary sector are non-Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Christians, mm-hmm, and of no faith at all.
Right.
So it needs to be something which is, let's say, empowering, in the sense that you can sit down with a Muslim and you can have a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I understand why you're doing that. That's because X, Y, and Z. That builds bridges.
Right.
But likewise, we as Muslims, we need to study about other faiths, not just as a scholastic exercise, but as an exercise of understanding who that individual is next door to us.
Mm-hmm. And why the way they are, why they are the way they are, what, why they do the things they do, and so forth.
Without a doubt. And therefore, mm-hmm, when we do that, we show respect, because the individual sees that we're taking an interest in them. And that interest is not one of denigration. That interest is one of, well, I understand where you're coming from, and I will do what I can not to offend your religious sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Islam asks from, mm-hmm, us, from us.
Mm-hmm.
As individuals here in this country.
So one of the drawbacks, this is a very, very good positive in terms of building bridges and mutual understanding, but the drawback, are there any drawbacks?
I think there are, definitely.
Yes.
I think if the way you teach Islam is a crucial element. It can be taught with the stick, and hence it drives the individual away from it. Or it can be taught in a manner which is rooted in love.
Mm-hmm.
And when you teach somebody the divine path predicated on love, i.e. The Sharia, Islam, etc., when you teach them predicated on love, they start to see what's being taught as something valuable, as something which, yeah, I need to take an interest in. So I think how the subject of Islamic studies is taught is very crucial. Now, within the school system, it would be very, I won't say ludicrous, but to go into the school and say, well, look, you've got to teach the students with love. But as we understand it as Muslims, that's the role of the teacher,
mm-hmm,
to show the student love. Your teachers, Sheikh, I'm sure they taught you with love because they wanted you, as an individual, to better yourself. With not only the knowledge which they provide you with, but for you to turn that knowledge into something practical, that it's not book knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's something which raises Ahmed Hanif to a higher level spiritually with his Lord. Islamic studies is about us connecting with Allah Azza wa Jal, using Islamic studies as a means to an end. The end is divine servitude, or servitude to the divine. So if I had my way, I would say Islamic studies should be taught with love, with care, with compassion to the students.
Mm-hmm. I think this indicates to me that the best way, or the best forum or context in which Islamic studies must be taught, has to be controlled by Muslims. In a sense that it has to, because the kind of love you're talking about, the kind of dimensions that you are approaching it from, even though, yes, in the secular, mm-hmm, system, mm-hmm, one can strive to to have that. Mm-hmm. You know, at the same time, it is only people who are rooted in that particular tradition, mm-hmm. you know, and at the same time also having contact with this non-Muslim environment that can probably do that.
I would say 95% of me says yes, Sheikh. Excuse me. There is an individual, or there was an individual called Anne-Marie Schmeichel.
Schmel. Yes, we have only like 50 seconds.
Yeah. Non-Muslim.
Right.
But taught Islam in a very, let's say, non-biased.
Exactly. Loving way.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
So if the individual has that, it doesn't matter what faith they are.
Yeah.
They see that the religion is there not to polarize individuals, but to bring them closer together.
Bring them closer together. Thank you very much. I think we're just out of time, and I think we ended up right on point. The teaching of religion is to bring mankind together. I want to thank you for joining us on Minbar. I hope we have you again some other time. And I want to thank you all for being with us as well. Remember, if you have any questions, comments, or criticisms, please don't forget us. Don't forget, sorry, to write us at minbar@presstv.ir. That's minbar@presstv.ir. And until next week, we will see you same time, same channel on Minbar.